I'm Michael Williams and welcome to Blueprint for Living. I'm not sure if they're allowed to listen to podcasts on the International Space Station, but if they are, once I've burned through both series of cereal, I'd like to picture the sounds of this week's episode of Blueprint piping through that floating metal box. We're looking at the future of space tourism, the ultimate in caravan holidays. So when it comes to planning that perfect holiday away, there are so many competing factors, aren't there? Cost, comfort. What about novelty, though? How can you come up with something that's truly exciting, that builds on your previous trips, maybe takes you to uncharted territory? Wilson De Silva is a science journalist, a documentary maker, and an editor-at-large at Cosmos magazine. He's also a ticket holder for Virgin Galactic. That's right. Wilson's going to space. Spaceship 2 is designed to be flown by a crew of two and carry up to six passengers. High-speed suborbital flight to the fringes of space. At an altitude above 100 kilometres, passengers will apparently experience a few minutes of weightlessness and see the Earth below. And Wilson joins us now. Wilson, what possessed you to buy a ticket for a ride on Virgin Galactic?
A dream I'd had since I was a child to... You know, I used to lie on Sydney in front lawn looking up at the stars and imagining myself exploring the galaxy. And it just seemed like a thing that was very exciting and mind-expanding, even as a 10-year-old child. But I didn't ever expect to actually do it. And when Virgin Galactic started offering tickets, I was lucky enough to be among the very first to grab it.
That is pretty exciting. How long ago did you buy the ticket?
10 years ago.
Okay. All right. Sorry. I'll modify my skepticism then. What did you pay 10 years ago for it?
10 years ago, they were selling them at $200,000. Now it's $250,000. $200,000 if you paid up in advance, the full ticket guaranteed you a chance to be amongst the first 100 to fly into space with Virgin Galactic Service, which I am. And my friend, Dr. Alan Finkel, who's now the Chief Scientist of Australia, we're both guaranteed to be amongst the first to fly.
Oh, that's exciting. So as I was saying, the intro, Spaceship 2 doesn't hold that many. Are you and your friend flying together? Is that the plan?
Yes, that's right. And his two sons, Alex and Victor. So we're going to be the four of us. It's going to be the ultimate geek bro ride.
Oh, God. I like that you chose geek bro. I mean, I don't want to get too kind of personal on this, but if you have to repopulate an alien planet, you're not going to do very well with Alan Finkel and his two sons.
I guess not, but we're just experiencing the magic space. If you like, I imagine that it's the same for Alan and for Victor and Alex, that we're all dreaming of the idea of actually experiencing being outside our own planet, looking down on the planet where all the history that we've read about and everyone we know and all of our civilization and our species and every other species that we know have come from down there. And to look from that, to look at the world from the outside, it's not just the experience of zero gravity, which itself will be very exciting, but it's the actual idea of doing it, of being outside your planet, something that has only been done by something like 500 people in all of human history. That is... it's an experience, and it changes people. A lot of people, particularly astronauts in the Apollo program who went very far to the moon, say that it substantially changed the people that they are, and we hope that we'll get a little bit of that.
Wilson, I'm going to be honest. Part of me is incredulous that you would do this, but hearing you talk has given me a little chill down my spine. I completely understand that kind of passion and that curiosity. Have you? I imagine you've had 10 years to do this. You've been researching it within an inch of its life. Have you had an indication of what the actual experience will be like, what you'll be able to see?
Yes, luckily. We were offered the opportunity to experience the G-forces that we're going to experience in a centrifuge that was used by the Gemini and Mercury astronauts in the US. So we're outside of Philadelphia. There's a facility, a very large kind of dumbbell structure on a long arm, weighing many, I think 100 tons or something like that. From the inside, it looks like the capsule. You're strapped in, and then it spins you around. And you experience, when we fly up, which is 2.5 Gs or 2.5 times regular gravity, and then on the way down, 6 Gs. Now, fighter pilots are rated to go to 9 Gs. That's what they need to do. And very few people can survive beyond 12 Gs. So 6 Gs is pretty up there, I have to say.
Yeah.
And the experience was fascinating. It is quite scary at first. You feel like there's a family of hippos sitting on your chest. But they train you in a series of techniques to how to continue breathing and not to panic, and how to actually use the muscles in your body to keep the blood from leaving your brain, which is essential because otherwise you'll pass out and you'll go through a kind of an epileptic fit. What's fascinating was that my brain knew that it was a simulation, but my body was convinced I'd just been shot out of a cannon and I was going to die.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds restful. But it's a suborbital flight, so that means it's not a terribly long experience. Are you concerned about the kind of the difficulties and the burdens of the flight overwhelming you so that you don't get to enjoy the stuff that you're looking forward to, your curiosity?
Look, it's part of the difficulty, isn't it? To get to space is difficult. A few years ago, in 2007, there was an explosion on the ground when they were testing the rocket. It killed 3 engineers.
And then
more
again,
recently, yeah.
2014?
That's right. There was a test flight where they were planning to actually go into space, and the component that's supposed to be released to slow down the craft deployed prematurely, and the whole craft disintegrated. So, look, there are risks with this sort of thing, and I wouldn't say that's one of the attractions. I mean, we just know that space is hard to get into, so you have to factor that in. But look, the whole trip is 2.5 hours, of which maybe we'll spend something between, 4 and 8 minutes in zero gravity to look down at the Earth. I think having gone through the ordeal of the climb, as it were, you'd enjoy the experience. It's kind of like climbing Mount Everest. You would go through an ordeal, but the experience is to be at the top and look down, and it's the same sort of thing. Having said that, going to space has a 3% non-return rate, whereas going to Mount Everest is 4.7, so I think even the odds are a little bit better.
Okay, good. I can see that's a source of comfort. Do you worry about the safety factor? I mean, is that something you think about a lot with this? Why rush to be in the first 100? Why not wait until they've got space tourism right and go once you can be much more confident of a return?
In a sense, you want to be there as soon as it's possible. And it isn't the case for me personally that I want to be in the first 100. It's a case that as soon as the experience is available, I'd love to experience it. So safety, yes, of course it does cross your mind. But, the very beginning of flying, something we do every day, began like this. It was very, very risky at the beginning of flight. In fact, in the first years of the 1920s, something like 25% of pilots died every year.
Wow. So as a science journalist, what's your sense? Do you think space tourism is going to take off in the future, or do you think it's one of those things that will be pushed out and pushed out?
It'll be a case of once the first few flights and maybe the first year of flying has proved to be safe and people are reporting back how wonderful it is, there'll be an amazing run of people. And what companies like Virgin Galactic and others are looking forward to is a day when you can do suborbital flights from, say, Sydney to London in 2 hours. That's the promise, and that's what people are hoping for.
Do you have a feel for when you're going to get the call from Virgin Galactic and it's time to finally fly?
Boy, it's actually been more than 10 years. 2004 was when we bought the tickets,
wow.
So it's been a while. I've been saying for a number of years now, next year, and so far I've been accurate. always next year.
I'm enjoying your optimism. I hope you go soon, and I hope it's everything that you've been looking forward to. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolute pleasure.
Wilson De Silva, science journalist, documentary maker, and editor-at-large at Cosmos Magazine. Well, I'm not going to pretend I'm 100% convinced. That's a man who clearly hasn't seen enough frightening science fiction films. So we're going to throw it open a little wider now and understand the context and the mechanics of this idea of space tourism. Jeff Faust is the editor of US-based Space Review, based in Baltimore, and Stephen Freeland is a professor of international law at Western Sydney University with a particular expertise in space law. They both join us down the line now. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us. Jeff, I'm going to start with you. Virgin Galactic's only one such company that's involved in this quest for space tourism. What other companies are working towards this, and where are they at?
Yeah, there are a couple of other companies working on vehicles designed like Virgin Galactic for suborbital spaceflight. One of them is Blue Origin. They're based in Seattle. They are funded by Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon.com. They are developing a vehicle called New Shepard that'll take off and land vertically, so it doesn't have wings, unlike Spaceship Two. It's already gone through several test flights at Blue Origin's test facility in West Texas, including some flights that have gone all the way to the edge of space and back. It's not yet ready to take people. They still want to do some more test flights, but probably in about 2 years, they believe it'll be ready to carry people. There's also another company called X-Core Aerospace. They were originally based just down the runway from Virgin Galactic in Mojave, California. They're in the process of moving to Texas, where they got a good deal to set up a facility in the city of Midland, Texas. They're developing a space plane called Lynx. It's a pretty small plane. It carries just two people, a pilot and a passenger. But it's also designed to take off from a runway, rocket up to the edge of space, and glide back to a landing. They hope to start test flights of the Lynx probably later this year. And so it's probably a couple of years away before it's ready to enter commercial service.
So is this essentially a kind of commercial tourism space race of its own? Virgin Galactic the furthest down the road to making this a reality?
It's fair to say that there is a race between these three companies in the suborbital space flight arena. There's no guarantee that Virgin Galactic will be the first to start carrying people, although they certainly are a leading candidate to do so. Blue Origin's making a lot of strides towards flight, and X-Core Aerospace hopefully will start flying pretty soon as well.
Can you talk us through the difference between suborbital flights and orbital ones? What's the different experience being offered potentially to the game tourist?
Suborbital spaceflight, as the name suggests, means you don't go into orbit. So unlike a satellite or the space station or something like that that's in orbit around the Earth, you simply go pretty much straight up to an altitude of about 100 kilometers or so and then come right back down without going into orbit. So you only get to spend several minutes in space. You get a taste of the zero-gravity environment and the view of the black sky and the view of the Earth out the window and so on, but you only get that for a matter of minutes rather than hours or days or weeks even if you're in orbit. Of course, a suborbital flight is going to be a lot less expensive than an orbital flight because you're not going all the way into space into orbit. The companies like Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin and X-Core are probably going to be charging in the range of $150,000 to $250,000 U.S. for a ticket. An orbital flight is probably going to cost in the tens of millions of dollars per ticket based on what the Russians have sold extra seats on their Soyuz missions to the space station in the past. So orbital is a longer experience, but it's also a more expensive one.
Nice to have a discount option there in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. What a perfect family holiday, I would have thought. That's an expensive bus trip. Stephen Freeland, I want to bring you in here because you've been watching this for some time. What do you make of this? Are we finally ready for space tourism as a concept?
Certainly, it sounds as if from a technological viewpoint we're ready. And as is the case with many space activities, not just limited to human spaceflight, the technology races ahead, but there are, of course, many other factors that need to be taken into account. There are lots of other regulatory issues and standards for safety and even ethical considerations that I really think will need to be sorted out before this can ever become an industry. And by industry, we're talking here about the potential for this to become, you know, large numbers of paying passengers on a commercial basis, so, rather than the odd person.
Safety concerns are obviously a big one, but who owns the space that these craft will be moving through?
Well, that in itself is an interesting question, although it's probably not the most important question. But Jeff was before talking quite rightly about some of these vehicles going to the edge of space and beyond. From a strictly legal framework, although, as I said, we can overcome these issues, we don't actually know where airspace ends and outer space begins. There's lots of theories and lots of suggestions. And that is relevant from a legal viewpoint because the international framework for airspace is very, very different and predicated on totally different assumptions than the legal framework for outer space. So we don't know where the demarcation is. It's very difficult from a regulatory viewpoint in any field to, if you like, put the basic framework of these are the minimum standards that are required, where at the same time, one doesn't completely understand the technology. The technology is moving. One doesn't understand necessarily all of the risks associated with that.
I can only imagine. I'm not convinced that my insurance when I travel internationally covers all the various needs. So it does seem like a minefield. Jeff, when do you think we're going to see these first commercial flights realistically?
I think realistically we're looking at flights carrying people within about the next 2 years. Now, the question will all three companies be ready to go in 2 years? It's possible that one or more of them may have a setback of some kind. To be clear, it's taken a lot longer than people expected for these vehicles to be developed. But we're now finally getting to the point where we're seeing real flight hardware and real flight hardware flying all the way to the edge of space. So we're getting a lot closer, even though it's taken a lot longer than we originally thought.
Thank you both so much for joining us today. Jeff Faust is editor of US-based Space Review, and Stephen Freeland is a professor of international law at Western Sydney University with an expertise in space law. Do let us know via the Blueprint for Living part of the RN website whether you'd be vaguely tempted. How many flights would it have to be before you decided it was time to part with your hard-earned cash? For me, I'm going to wait, I think. You're listening to Blueprint for Living here on RN with me, Michael Williams.
To be or not to be.
It is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath.
Swear not by the moon, the inconstant moon, that monthly changes in her circled orb, lest that thy love prove likewise variable.
You know, Shakespeare wrote so many great lines. Head to the RN website, look for The Bard, and vote for your favourite piece of Shakespeare.
It's a bit of a recurring theme on this show. People who have managed to contort their professional life or the way they holiday or the way they live to fit their personal obsessions. And our next guest is no exception. He's a self-confessed tragic for mid-century modernism, as well as being a comedian and broadcaster. Tim Ross has shaped an old-style variety show around that passion for architecture, and it's called Man About the House. He runs it in modernist houses around the country with musician Kit Warhurst, and I caught up with Tim at Robin Boyd's Walsh Street House in the Melbourne suburb of South Yarra. It's a legend of 50s architecture, and he was there setting up for yet another sold-out show.
Modernism, modernism. Anyone knocking them down should go to prison. Modernism, what a vision. They are the houses that just keep on giving. Modernism, that's fascism.
So you've been doing the show for 4 years. Why mid-century modernism for you? When did that obsession start?
Well, gosh, I think it was from growing up in the suburbs. And I think the wonderful thing about Australia was the explosion of great architecture happened here in the 1950s and 60s and into the 70s. And being a kid of the 70s, all those places with the houses in the suburbs where I was growing up, modernism was the architecture on our TV screens, whether it was the Skippy House or it's Hawaii Five-O, even the Brady Bunch House, even if those sort of slightly kitsch examples of it, it's what we grew up with. And I think it was very much that idea of the future, that there was something very, I think, for people of our generation, there was something very appealing about modernism, very futuristic, and that represented the great houses of my youth, I suppose.
Why this house? Why Boyd?
Oh, this house is fantastic, and it's the architect's own house, and it's experimental. It's a Melbourne icon, and I wish it was better known throughout Australia, but it's one of the great houses of the 1950s, and it's a truly Australian home. It's just breathtaking, and it's very modern in the way that you feel about it when you walk in, and it's an experimental house. So where we've just walked into what appears to be a normal front door, you're actually, on the left-hand side is a bathroom, but the first thing you walk into, what looks like a lounge room, but it is a lounge room, but it's also their bedroom, and there's a day bed that Robin slept in for all his life and his wife slept in, and it looks like a lounge room. But at night, the cushions go away and the day bed turns into a proper bed. And when people come to the show tonight, we'll come in and they'll feel like it's a lounge room. And on the left-hand side, their ensuite becomes the powder room for guests. So a fascinating use of space and an extraordinary use of space.
What role does Boyd play for you? Because this show and the work that you do with this show is all about a personal obsession. Is Boyd one of the greats as far as you're concerned?
The thing with Robin Boyd is that there's lots of things with it. Having been in a bunch of his houses, you know, particularly performed in a couple of his houses now, and what sort of strikes me about him as an architect is that Kit and I always put things in terms of, I suppose, music, because he's a very serious musician, but I love music as well, and there's music in the show. And his houses are almost like, when you go to a different one of his houses, it's like an artist, and it's like listening to a new record, and there's a familiarity to the work. But somehow, you know, this is a new album, and I feel that about Robin's work. But what's interesting about Robin Boyd for me personally is being a kid of the suburbs, where I grew up in Mount Eliza, it's almost like Robin's been this constant in my life. And there was this house in Frankston that I drove past for years every time I went to school, or we went down to the shops in Frankston. I always looked at it and wondered about it. And then I went there for Robin Boyd open day and finally got to go inside. And then when I went to university, where I went to Latrobe University in Melbourne, Menzies College, where I did all my theatre, was a theatre that was designed by Robin Boyd. And then you come here and then we do this show in this Robin Boyd house, and then I've just done it in this documentary series for the ABC that's got so much of Robin Boyd in it. It feels like he's somehow this constant in my life, which is really quite extraordinary.
What's it like to do a show in this house? Because you've done a couple in this one before. You've got another one tonight. Your Melbourne run this time around for Man About the House is all sold out. What's it like to be in a space like this and doing the kind of comedy that you're doing?
It's a privilege, I suppose, is the best thing. And I love how people walk into this space and they're drawn in and they're wide-eyed, because essentially, as Tony Lee, who's the director of the Boyd Foundation, always says so wonderfully, it's like a very fancy bedsit, because you come in and the bedroom's upstairs, and then you go downstairs and there's a lounge room and an open plan kitchen. For the 1950s, it's so extraordinary. But then there's two pavilions to the house, and where we are is in the front pavilion, where we're in the lounge room I've been talking about, but the back pavilion's for the kids. And to go there, you have to go outside to go to the kids' bedrooms. They've got their own section out the back. And in the middle of this courtyard that's all walled in with these walls of glass, this sort of opaque coloured glass. And Robin knew that being in the middle of South Yarra, that over the years there was a chance that there was going to be flats on either side, there'd be apartments. So he reinvented the backyard by putting a courtyard in the middle. It's this extraordinary courtyard, but the kids, I love, would have to, in the middle of Melbourne winters, have to essentially walk outside to get to their bedrooms. So it's a really great way of disconnecting your kids from your life. But, you know, the idea of being here, and I've stayed here a few times, which is really lucky, is that we're in a living museum, which is my favourite type of museum, a museum where you're allowed to sit on the furniture, where you can engage in the place, you can drink, you can be in a house in the way that it's meant to be. Houses come alive with people in them. And when you suddenly put 60, 70 people in this house for essentially, it's like a party. It's like going to someone's dinner party without the food, where a couple of people get up and tell a story that goes for an hour. But you can probably enjoy this one. It's really, really wonderful, and it's an extraordinary space. I don't think it's, in many ways, the most practical space in lots of ways. You can see here that we're on a platform in this top level, and there's no handrails, so if you wake up in the middle of the night, you could walk straight off. But I just love this place. I think it's really important Australian home.
And the nature of doing the show here means that you get to basically play act of being host. Like, you're inviting these people into a house and putting them at ease in that space. How much do you set up this space when they come into it? How much do you talk them through?
Well, it depends on the night and depends who's here and how. You can always tell a design crowd, and they tend to be the first ones to come, and they'll know a lot more, so sometimes you're preaching to the choir. But, you know, we've done comedy festival shows here where a lot of people have come into the house for the first time and really just come along because they're, oh, I want to see Rosso do a stand-up show. And that's a great way for people to sort of get part of the original idea of this show, is to get people to enjoy design and look at Australian design and look at architecture in a completely different way and take some of the stuffiness out of it. If you're just here and you're existing and you're being in the space, it's without being bored, senseless about me saying all sorts of things, or someone else who's far more worthy and knows more about it. It's just about the experience of being in an extraordinary home and just soaking it in or taking the time to look at something. A lot of the theatres that we go to for performances are amazing, but we don't think about them in terms of their space. But here it's really like Kit and I saying, being brave enough as performers with massive egos, or performers egos, to say, you know what, we're happy to share the stage with the theatre. And this is an extraordinary theatre, and really, it truly is the star of the show.
Let's walk out onto this deck and look out over the garden and the children's area. That is very civilised to have your children at arm's length.
It's probably 10 metres away from the first pavilion, and where we're standing on the balcony, there's this enormous long piece of Oregon that is the balcony rail, and there's nothing underneath it. So if you had a toddler, I've had my kids here, you've got to be on guard the whole time. But, you know, you sort of peek down and you can look out and you can see the dandenongs, and you can see that there's these extraordinary steel lines that come across that hold the roof up. So it really is quite enclosed. It's very, very private. So when you are in the courtyard, or even though there's glass on either ends, you're really feeling like you're secluded. And it's very easy, apart from that sort of hum that you might be able to hear now from the traffic from Punt Road. And, you know, we've got to remember, we're not far from the MCG here. You do feel like you are secluded, and it's a beautiful little courtyard, and a very old-fashioned courtyard. It's full of fruit trees and classic nana plants. So it's very old-fashioned in the terms of its fruit trees, but very Australian in its materiality.
Love it. Let's go downstairs.
The other thing worth mentioning here is that the house is full of these wonderful original Featherstone chairs, and Robin and Grant were great collaborators and friends. And so, you know, you've got this, I call them the Dennis Lilly and Rod Marsh of Australian design, because essentially they've got this great partnership. So Robin has a house full of the Featherstone chairs, and then the Featherstones have a Robin Boyd house where they put their own furniture together, and there's a great partnership going on there. And then you come down into this open plan lounge room where there's a dinner party space with this beautiful cork table where they were great entertainers, and beautiful furniture in here, and this open fireplace with this gorgeous copper flue. It's a hood, but it's a signature of a lot of Robin's places. And then, of course, you're looking back out into the courtyard, and the floor is just bricks. They're in a pattern and sealed, and they're beautiful. It's a really rustic feel to this place, and it's very rough in lots of ways, and there's not a lot of materials used, but everything just works beautifully together.
So it's taken you to Palm Springs, you're about to go to Venice, to London. This is all just a pretty dodgy boondoggle.
Yeah, look, we've been really lucky, yeah, because we've been doing it for a while, and social media has opened up a lot of doors for us, and it's much easier for people to understand what it is. So, you know, we're on Twitter or something, and someone from Farnsworth House says, "Oh, call us. We want you to come." And it's like, okay, we'll do that. We're just going to make the time to do it and work out how we're going to make it work. But it is an extraordinary opportunity for us to be able to go into some of the best houses. All the big names we've managed to do over the years, whether Glenn Murcutt and Robin Boyd or Roy Grounds, they're all there. The Harry Seidler, all the heavy hitters.
If the Julian architect's crown and vision, let the sunshine in, my friends, it's modernism.
Music there by Tim Ross's collaborator Kit Warhurst. There's information on Kit and Tim's Man About the House Tassie shows that are coming up this weekend on the Blueprint for Living program page. Travelling the world doing shows in beautiful houses? Now that's a good idea. Still to come, we get Susan Mousehart's take on the new $5 note and more besides.
You're listening to Blueprint for Living with Michael Williams on RN. Keep up with the latest in design, food, travel and gardens. Subscribe to our weekly podcast on iTunes or the ABC Radio app.
There is something particularly nice about classical good work that still holds a place in an age of changing technologies and changing needs, and botanical illustration is one such area. It's 200 years of the Royal Botanic Gardens, Sydney, and as part of their program, one of the things they're doing is an exhibition around the Margaret Flockton Award. The Margaret Flockton Award celebrates scientific botanical illustration. That's that art that translates the complex science into precise drawings. It is a thing of beauty, and I'm joined today by one of the award exhibition's co-curators and this year's winner. Leslie Elkin is co-curator of the award exhibition. She's an award judge and a botanical illustrator in her own right. Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning. Good
Thanks
morning,
so much
Michael.
For joining us. Tell us a little bit, first of all, about this award. Why is it important to have an international prize for scientific botanical illustrating?
Well, there are many illustrators around the world working in herbaria and botanic gardens, and the majority of them work on their own, and their work is published in scientific publications, which are rarely seen by the general community. So this award was set up at the Botanic Gardens to try and allow people to be exposed to this amazingly detailed work and to see how plants are classified and how they're described.
How important is it now? I mean, I imagine we're in an age where a lot of this illustration is probably computerised. Surely there's an app for it, Leslie. Why is it important that people are doing it by hand still?
We haven't actually delved too much into using computers for illustration. I believe there are some people doing it. But we feel that when you're interpreting a plant, you actually need a brain in between the eyes and the hand. So we are able to interpret information from a variety of specimens, and many of the specimens that we work from are actually just herbarium specimens, which are pressed and dried, often up to 100 or more years old. So we can try and recreate what the plant looked like, or what we think the plant looked like, with the aid of the botanist's description, to try and bring it back to life rather than just photographing an old press plant.
I can definitely see the value of the brain between the hand and the plant. So tell us a bit about Margaret Flockton, because the prize is named for her.
Yes, Margaret Flockton was our first illustrator, and she started in 1901 when she was 40. She was also a trained lithographer, and she was trained in London, one of the first six women trained in London in lithography, and when she came to Australia, she was the only female lithographer in Sydney.
So what made her work so outstanding?
She was an amazing draftsperson. Her eye for detail was really unsurpassed. She has beautiful line mark making, so her lines are beautiful, and she had just enough detail to show everything you need to see without excessive information.
Oh, fantastic. Well, not just her work, but her name now lives on thanks to the prize, the award. And we have this year's award winner here in the studio with me. Pauline Dewar, congratulations. You're the 2016 Margaret Flockton Award winner. That's pretty thrilling. Tell us about the plant you drew for the competition and why you chose it.
Well, I had two plants, both of them ferns, fairly closely related, Pilea falcata and Pilea nana, which is a smaller version. There's some discussion as to whether they're the same species, but I didn't really get into that.
So tell me what's challenging about this kind of work. How closely do you need to study the plant you're drawing, or do you study it at all?
Oh, yes. You always have to have it in front of you when you're drawing it. I guess I'm blessed because I've got them both growing in my backyard, and I find it impossible to work without the actual live plant in front of me. You really need to be very aware what you're illustrating and try and demonstrate all the appropriate features that make it the specimen and the species that it is.
And the precision and the delicacy of it's amazing to me. Are there rules and regulations about what you have to include when you do it?
There are rules and regulations. It's interesting, though, that even though the rules and regulations are tight, I think Leslie would probably agree that we can pick works that are done by specific illustrators by the technique and the interpretation of the rules.
I just want to check, what do you use? Is it just pen and ink?
It's pen and ink, and you use a technical pen, a rotring technical pen with a nib diameter of 0.13, which I think is the finest that you can get in Australia.
And no colour at all?
No colour.
You don't get the Derwents out afterwards and just a bit of shading? I could help you with that.
You'd
I'm a very
tempted.
Good colour. It's definitely my special area. I'm curious, how did you get into this kind of illustrating? Because you previously worked as a GP, and I understand you've only done a handful of these kind of illustrations.
Yes, I've done 12.
I've entered straight to award winner.
Not really. It took 6 years. You can enter two illustrations in the Margaret Flockton Award, and I've entered two each year for the last 6 years. So I guess I do have the luxury of time. But, it's just a field of interest of mine, and it's an extension of botanical art that I find a bit of a challenge.
So, Leslie, I'm interested because as well as being a co-curator of the exhibition and a judge, you're also one of the illustrators for the Royal Botanic Garden, so you have your own method and your own kind of contribution to this. How does scientific illustrating differ from botanical illustrating that we'd be more familiar with? Is it crucial to get all the precise scientific features of the plant completely correct?
That's right. In scientific illustration, our role is to clearly define all of those key features that Pauline was talking about. And these features are determined by a botanist when they're describing the plant. So we are led by the botanists, whereas botanical art is more about the beauty of plants.
I understand you use a special kind of microscope. Tell us about that. How does that work?
We use a drawing microscope, which is a binocular microscope. It's a wonderful tool because it allows us to actually trace our specimens rather than having to measure and draw. What it allows us to do is with one eye looking straight down to the specimen and another eye looking across using a system of mirrors, you can see your hand superimposed by light over the specimen. I'm left-handed, so I'm drawing to the left on a piece of paper, but I can see my hand above the specimen.
Pauline talked about having a preference for having the live plant in front of her, but you mentioned earlier that some of the specimens you're drawing from the Sydney Botanic Gardens are over 100 years old. How have those ones been preserved?
Well, I actually work in the National Herbarium, where we have over 1.2 million specimens of pressed plants and also specimens we call spirit material, so it's suspended in alcohol. And these plants have been pressed and dried on collection, and we have good climate control within that building to allow them to stay preserved. And they actually stay pretty similar to how they were when they were collected 100 or 200 years ago. We have specimens dating back to the Banks and Solander collection from 1788.
And so are you kept in business as long as science keeps making more and more discoveries?
Oh, we hope so. We do have a big list of plants that we need to draw. Botanists are continually finding new species or re-describing species. So as long as they keep finding things, hopefully we'll still be allowed to draw them.
Pauline, 6 years, 12 illustrations, and now you've won this prize. What's the next one you're going for? What's the white whale of illustration ahead of you?
I think Margaret Fupton's probably the peak. I think you drift off down another track, down towards perhaps watercolour painting.
Oh, right, there goes the ambition. Forget the precision. You're now ready for a nice watercolour. Well, I suspect you will do as well on that as you have with this. It's been lovely to speak to you both. Leslie Elkin. Leslie's co-curator of the Margaret Flockton Award exhibition, an award judge and a botanical illustrator with the Sydney Royal Botanic Gardens. And Pauline Dewar, who's this year's Margaret Flockton Award winner. There's an image of Pauline's winning entry and one of Margaret Flockton's own work up on the Blueprint for Living part of the RN website. But you can catch the exhibition relating to the award at the Sydney Botanic Gardens. Follow the links on our website for details and opening hours. It's free entry. For a different kind of artistic pursuit now, though, we're going to Sense of Place and Australian artist Susan Norrie coming up in just a tick. In 2007, Susan Norrie, one of this country's most highly regarded artists, represented Australia at the Venice Biennale. The work that took her there was a monumental work. It was called Havoc, and it was an exploration of the Lucy volcano disaster. I don't know if you remember, that was the mud volcano that erupted in May 2006 in Sidoarjo, Indonesia, and had a devastating impact on the local population, many of whom lost their homes and their livelihoods. The mud volcano, thought to be triggered by the blowout of a nearby gas well, is still active today, and even though there have been all kinds of efforts to investigate and mitigate the impact, the mudflow continues to cause disruption to the lives of local communities living in the area. Susan Norrie's returned to the site of the world's largest mud volcano in East Java. It's 10 years, obviously, since her last work from there, and she's made a new moving image work called Aftermath, which she describes as a meditation on community, loss and resilience against a bleak backdrop of large-scale environmental destruction. And she joins us to share her sense of that devastated place. So, when did you first visit Sidoarjo?
I first visited Sidoarjo in 2006. Originally, I found an image in the newspaper in May 2006 of a small house in mud. And in fact, at the time, it reminded me of a previous work, Undertow, which I exhibited at ACCA in 2002. and it was shot at night, and I was sort of haunted by this image. So I pursued the idea of this being the project for the Venice Biennale.
So had you spent a lot of time in Indonesia prior to that?
No. I was fortunate enough when I was in my adolescent actually to go to Bali and Taiwan and to Japan, and I'd also spent a certain amount of time actually in Southeast Asia during my 20s and 30s, but it was really my first time to East Java in 2006.
And it was that image that drew you there, that made you know that you wanted to make work in that space.
Yes, yeah. And also I feel too that I've been interested in natural and man-made disasters for many years now, and I wasn't necessarily chasing misery at all. I hesitated at first in terms of pursuing this project because I knew I was entering a zone which was quite new, where previously I was either working with archival footage or sort of like Greenpeace footage with Undertow, or I was shooting my own footage or working with people on sites that were either in Japan or in New Zealand, all cultures actually which are based around the Ring of Fire. I think this has been a predominant preoccupation in my practice over many years now.
What is it about natural and man-made disasters that inspires a kind of artistic impulse in you? Because I completely get what you're saying. There must be a real tension when you go into a place in kind of capturing it and documenting it for art.
It's that thing of human error, which is always a possibility. I also feel too that we as humans actually haven't dealt with nature in the way that we could have, you know, that we've exploited nature. We've also exploited people often in circumstance, say, in highly densely populated areas, especially you find in sort of countries like Indonesia or even Japan for that matter. And I think that in many ways what's been happening in Southeast Asia and Asia Pacific in the last number of years has a lot to do with climate change, but it also equally has a lot to do with, sometimes I kind of think it's this of the force of nature, like a sort of reminder that we need to readjust the way in which we deal with the world. And so I guess the idea of dealing with man-made and natural disasters is also to a degree a comment on where we are, you know, like it's a sort of reckoning of sorts.
So whereabouts in Indonesia is Sidoarjo?
It's in East Java. I mean, you basically fly from Bali to Surabaya, and then it's about, I'd say, an hour's drive from Surabaya.
So what was it like going back there 10 years after your original visit? Because unlike being there in the immediate wake of the disaster, it would have been a...
Yes, it was quite different actually, because with the disaster in 2006 and 2007, it was a unique accident that occurred. I mean, I think everyone feels that it was ultimately an oil gas drilling incident, mining incident at the time. But, you know, and you would question actually to why actually they were drilling in such a sort of volatile and seismic sort of region anyway. And there had been a history actually of mud volcanoes in the area anyway. And in fact, actually, it's very interesting because mud volcanoes are an indication of gas and oil deposits anyway, all through the world. And so it was a very sort of messy, complicated situation. There's a lot of shame, I think, associated with it, which is not dissimilar to Fukushima in that way, where a lot of the media and the government and also the sort of multinational companies were suppressing it. So when I went back actually in 2015 and then in 2016, actually I made two trips back, it was extraordinary because the villages, which I remember, that were sinking into the mud no longer existed at all. 13 villages were now buried under this hardened landscape of mud, which was pretty extraordinary. So it was quite devastating.
You're listening to Blueprint for Living on RN with me, Michael Williams, and I'm talking to artist Susan Norrie about her time spent in and around East Java, documenting the aftermath of the Lucy volcano disaster of 2006-2007. Susan, unlike most natural disasters, a volcano is an ongoing reality. The site stays active, and so presumably the people there not only have to deal with the cleanup from the disaster, but they have to adapt their life. How much did you find that to be the case when you returned?
That was the extraordinary aspect of going back, because on a daily basis, 7 days a week, these men actually worked for BPLS, which was an agency formed by the Indonesian government to deal with the mud disaster in 2008. I mean, they had a prior agency, but they realised around 2008 that this was going to be an ongoing sort of kind of disaster zone. So these guys actually, on a 7 day a week, 10 hours a day, dredge the mud. They have these ponds around the Lucy Mud Volcano, and they flush water into it, and then they with the mud, and that is then transported through to Pahrong River. And I did quite a lot of research to find out the impact on the people in the Pahrong River, and especially in relationship to the shrimp farmers. And it's a pretty devastating situation, but at the same time, I think that humans manage to adapt under certain conditions. And that really, to be quite honest, it's all that they can do for the moment. It has subsided, obviously, a huge amount, the Lucy Mud Volcano, but it's still having an impact on the area. I actually ended up sort of also pursuing the idea of, on my second trip, of being in contact with a company called AlterTrade, which was a Japanese-Indonesian company that works with shrimp harvesters, which have a sort of traditional practice going back 300 years, and they work with the tides and the moon. So when they and that was kind of very interesting for me to sort of observe that life kind of goes on, so to speak, but equally too that these guys who were sort of stopping further mud going into more villages were, you know, round the clock working. I think the other thing that was extremely sort of curious and interesting to me, I met a guy called Hardy Prosetto, who's the chairman of BPLS, and he was attempting to convince me that, you know, this could eventually in the future be made into a geopark. And I'm not, you probably don't know what a geopark is, but it's actually a, it has to be ratified by UNESCO, United Nations, but basically it's a site where you have people being able to attract monies for scientific research, ecotourism, and also studying the site in terms of prior mud volcanic activity in relation to history. I mean, there's a kind of dark tourism to that, of course, as well. But I suppose because of all the ongoing debate around whether it's a man-made or natural disaster, and luckily, actually, compensation has pretty much been paid. I think it's been paid out to the tune of 99% now, which is a huge sort of relief. But I think that they don't know really what to do to stop it. But they need, obviously, money. They need further scientific research. So this was another way to kind of think about a future. But unfortunately, I just couldn't, at this point in time, depict that in my work because it didn't exist yet. I mean, sure. It was actually in a process, like a vision, like an idea for the future. So I decided to deal with the workers on the ground, and not unlike the ponds actually for the harvesters, the shrimp farmers as well. So you have the ponds for the Lucy Mud Volcano, and then in the same area, in exactly the same area, not very far away, you have the shrimp harvesters in their ponds.
You describe the need for artists to bear witness to events with, I think the phrase you use is a kind of poetic detachment.
Mm.
Was that possible in a context like Siduaja? I mean, I can see the importance of it artistically, and I understand that, but it must be incredibly hard when faced with the kind of devastation that you were faced with.
I think what is changing in Indonesia, and obviously in Japan, probably more so in Japan than Indonesia at the moment, is that disaster management, disaster prevention, disaster mitigation, and also I think with the new president, President Widodo, and especially in relation to what happened last year in Paris with the climate change conference, I just think that people are becoming more accountable. They can't really get away with what happened in 2006 and 2007 with the Lucy Mud Volcano, nor in Japan, actually, Fukushima could ever happen again. Regulations have taken place. People are expected to deal with things in a much more substantial and profound way around these sort of issues. You know, you can't just exploit people, and you can't get away with corruption at a level that's occurred in the past.
Susan Norrie, thank you so much for joining us on Blueprint for Living. Susan Norrie's moving image work Aftermath, 2016 work, which features Siduaja heavily, is part of her exhibition Fieldwork 2006 to 2016. It's on at the Ian Potter Museum of Art in Melbourne until Sunday, the 3rd of July 2016. And Susan Norrie's been my guest this morning. You're listening to Blueprint for Living here on RN. I'm Michael Williams. In dubiously received design news, the new $5 note was unfurled to sceptical fanfare this week. But the particular pleasures of that purple piece of polymer aside, how much does physical currency matter anymore? It's clearly time for Susan Mousehart to share her obituary for another sinking ship of culture. Here's Dr. Mousehart with her diagnosis for the state of banknotes.
Let's take lots of money. Money is divine.
Now that we know what our new $5 note will look like, how pleasant to be reminded that cash is practically obsolete anyhow. Unveiled by the Reserve Bank this week, the new bill has been widely hailed as the iSnack 2.0 of the currency world.
It turned thousands of Australians into unhappy little Vegemites.
Among other random visual elements, the new design features a scowling queen. The word specimen stamped across her face could explain that. And sprays of native flora that look alarmingly like something you'd find on a laboratory slide. More golden staff than golden wattle. Social media wasted no time in paying out the new design. Looks like vomit, hideous, and like a primary school mural, were among the more considered opinions. Photoshoppers had a field day posting parody designs, among them the Cliver, featuring Clive Wooden Nickel Palmer sporting a sumptuously styled updo.
I can't take any questions on that because it's before the court, so I'm not going to answer questions.
We haven't seen currency cringe on this scale since, 2015, when a petition calling for the national currency to be renamed Dollary Dues attracted more than 45,000 signatures.
$900 dues? Tobias! Did you accept a six-hour collect call from the states?
According to the RBA, the new design is the culmination of a process of extensive consultation with focus groups, banks, and subject matter experts. Well, we all get 5 minutes of fame, and I guess the prickly Moses Wattle specialists have waited longer than most for theirs. The synergies released as a result of such design by committee have been well documented. There's even a technical term for it. Dog's breakfast. Luckily for all of us, money isn't everything. In fact, and increasingly, it isn't anything. Americans only use cash for about 40% of transactions. Here in Australia, that figure is less than 20%. Soon, experts tell us, ATMs, once the pinnacle of fiduciary high tech, will be as rare as phone booths in the desert. And even panhandlers will accept PayPal. In Sweden, they already do. There, even church collections are conducted via apps and collect-o-mart card machines. Cash or credit, Jesus still saves. A cashless society sounds kind of scary until you look at that $5 note again. Anyhow, they say money is just energy. Well, that makes sense, I guess. Because I don't have any of that either. Now the gravy trains run
over you. Susan Mousehart there, celebrating the rise of the cashless economy. You can find earlier installments of Susan's Sinking Ships of Culture up on our part of the RN website. And while you're there, we're looking for something from you. We're doing a story next week on hitchhiking. Obviously, hitchhiking's stupid, irresponsible, dangerous, ill-advised. Obviously. But it makes for great stories, and I have no doubt you've got them. So share them with us. Record yourself on your smartphone and email it to us at blueprintforliving@your.abc.net.au. That's blueprintforliving, all one word, at your.abc.net.au. Or go to our Facebook page and you'll find a relevant thread there to join into. Good, bad, ugly, we want your hitchhiking stories. But that's for the future. Still to come on today's show, we get elbow deep in porridge. Well, the topic of porridge, not literally. But before we get there, we're going to do our best to resurrect the good name of wallpaper. Stay with us.
You're listening to Blueprint for Living with Michael Williams on RN.
I'm going to confess something. Now, I am not, to be brutally honest, what you would call a fashionable or on-trend person. When I become enthusiastic about a question of style or an aesthetic or a new cafe, it is generally a sign it's just become completely obvious and no one's doing that anymore. But even I have noticed that wallpaper, poor, maligned, put-upon, insulted wallpaper, seen as a cheap and shabby option, is suddenly on the rise again. Suddenly, it's a thing people talk about, a thing people covet, a thing they want in their designer homes. What's happened? How's it been resurrected? I'm joined right now via Skype from Chicago by Jude Stewart, who's a Chicago-based design writer and journalist and author of a number of books, including the wonderfully named Paternalia, An Unconventional History of Polka Dots, Stripes, Plaid, Camouflage and Other Graphic Patterns. And also joined from Sydney by Michael Leck, who's a curator at the Caroline Simpson Library and Research Collection. He's also a wallpaper expert. Good morning to you both. Jude Stewart, I'm going to start with you. You recently wrote a wonderful article about the rise of wallpaper, the history of wallpaper, and in it you put forward the interesting theory that wallpaper is inherently mendacious, it lies. Why do you say that?
Well, I think it goes back to the history of wallpaper. It was invented essentially to be a cheaper alternative of some of the other wall coverings that were prevalent in richer people's homes. So you would have tapestry or leather or wood covering your walls, which is both beautiful and functional. In the time of before insulation, it was very important to have these unsightly cracks covered up, and to have a little extra layer was helpful to keep the heat in. So if you couldn't afford those fancy things, then you would have wallpaper.
All about
so it's essentially
faking.
Imitative. Faking it, right.
Right. So when were those earliest usages? What are the earliest records you could find?
Well, the very earliest record of wallpaper is from 105 AD. So pretty much at the moment when a Chinese court official named Cai Lung invented paper, it started being decorated and put on walls. But it really sort of would be recognizably wallpaper starting in Europe in the 15th century. There were these prints called domino prints that were sort of devotional or political in nature, and those started cropping up everywhere. And then probably a really big heyday of wallpaper starts around 1600s and kind of goes through the 19th century.
Michael Leck, I might bring you in here. You've explored this history of wallpaper for your work with the Caroline Simpson Library and Research Collection. What was, to your mind, the height of popularity for wallpaper?
It was probably the second half of the 19th century, really, and that was in Australia and probably through much of the Western world. And one of the reasons is that wallpaper started to be produced using large rotary machines from about 1840. Prior to that, all wallpaper was made by hand. That meant using wood blocks or stencils. The mechanisation of wallpaper meant that the price of wallpaper came down and the number of patterns that were available went up exponentially. And even those who were, you know, on very humble incomes could afford to wallpaper their walls. And so there was an explosion of use of wallpaper in that second half of the 19th century.
What were the original methods of making it and designing it then before mechanisation changed that process?
Well, as I mentioned, using woodblocks, in the same way an artist might have produced a woodblock print, some people might be familiar with that, you just carve out the pattern in the block of wood and then press it onto the paper and create the impression of the pattern.
Jude Stewart, that level of kind of labour intensivity, as Michael says, I mean, that must have in some way made it not just a cheap option for people looking to cover up things they wanted covered.
Absolutely, absolutely. But you have the full gamut, as Michael suggests. So, you know, if you have to cover your walls with, you know, newspaper or whatever paper you can just to get the functional benefit, then sure, you'll do that. But if you can aspire to have something look a little nicer, then of course you will do that. So there's sort of an aspirational longing that creates papers at every price point. And as Michael notes, you know, after the Industrial Revolution, there's so many more choices and the price is so much cheaper that if anything, wallpaper kind of runs amok. And there are some extremely garish wallpaper patterns and there's sort of design backlash against this profusion. So that's the kind of fun period too.
So that's what happens when it becomes too popular, is suddenly it's everywhere and it loses standards or something?
Right. There was a big portion of the Great Exhibition in London in 1851 that was devoted to wallpaper. And so it's sort of showing what all the fancy new machines can do in terms of creating wallpaper patterns. And, you know, all the design critics of the time were horrified and many people wrote lots of screeds against these, you know, ghastly papers and decried the standards of you know, what was on display, to the point where it's kind of interesting because it's sort of like, well, so because it's democratic and a lot of people are interested in it, now it has to be terrible.
I love it. Early hipsterism.
You know, you can't entirely believe this. Yeah, exactly. Right.
If it's that popular, so. It can't be any good. I know you did a lot of research across kind of works that talk about literary references to wallpaper. Is it generally written about in a positive or a negative light?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that, because it's almost always written about in a negative light. because I was pointing out in this article at The Atlantic, I know that wallpaper is sort of a very cinematic, it's sort of a cinematic aspect of literature. It's useful in that it reveals character really quickly. It can reveal sort of mismatches in social situations, people who feel out of place, people who kind of don't know, you know, how they appear to other people, or perhaps trying to put one over on someone else. I found a book that was just chock full of literary references, and most of them are negative.
Do you have particular favorites?
So I don't know what that says. Do I have a particular favorite? I think the best one is an entire short story from 1892 called The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman. And it is about a young married woman who's taken to the country for a rest cure. And she's staying in this bedroom that has a kind of ugly yellow wallpaper. And she becomes more and more claustrophobically obsessed with this paper. And all her sort of nervous fantasies and neuroses come out in sort of picking apart, at one point, literally, this wallpaper. And by the end of the story, she sort of chains herself in the room and she's never going to leave. So it's sort of an interesting commentary on how claustrophobic women's lives were at that period.
The oppressive nature of it. I have pictures of kind of Warner Brothers cartoons with people picking at little corners and whole walls coming away and stuff. It was that idea that it's even in our language, papering over the cracks is never thought of as a good thing. Michael, what was Australia's particular story with wallpaper? How was it used in the early days of the colonies?
One of the things about Australia was that wallpaper was used right through the country, not just in cities but in countryside, in very grand homesteads as well as in slab huts. Of course, it covered the gaps in the boards. And often, retrospectively, we've found that several layers of wallpaper have been pasted one on top of the other over the boards to provide extra levels of insulation. But of course it was a quick way of decorating, you know, a very humble looking place.
And I understand the glue has an interesting story behind it too.
Well, the glue, which typically in the 19th century was just a simple starch paste, was a good attraction for pests, for silverfish and mice and all sorts of other pests. And it was another reason why wallpaper gained a poor reputation by the end of the 19th century, because if you pasted several layers of wallpaper and you had old glue there, it just seemed to attract more and more pests.
So, Michael, how did changes in paint manufacturing influence the decline of wallpaper?
Well, if you go back to the 19th and early 20th century, the two types of paint that were most commonly available were, one was a water-based paint. Some people might remember the name calcimine or whitewash. It was very cheap and affordable, but as soon as any damp was attached to it, basically it would start to flake. Alternatively, you could buy lead-based paint, which was very expensive. Wallpaper, in comparison, in the early 20th century, was very cheap. By the time you get to the post-World War II period, a paint manufacturer becomes a lot more sophisticated and becomes a real threat to wallpaper as far as price goes and usability as well. You're able to start wiping the paint down so that if it becomes marked, for instance, whereas with most wallpaper you couldn't do that.
Jude, why do you think there is a resurgence in wallpaper? Firstly, do you agree that there's a bit of a resurgence? And if so, why?
I think that's an interesting question, whether or not there's a resurgence, but I'm going to go with yes. Let's say there is.
That's handy. Thank you.
Why not? Yes. But I think the reason is it was so incredibly out that it had to eventually come back in. So that's one. Sort of the design pendulum always swings. In one extreme, it will absolutely come back fiercely in the other direction. But the other reason that is maybe more thinky, if you will, is I think the prevalence of screens has kind of given us a different feeling anyway about the nature of walls and what that projects into a room or into a reality. So, you know, a lot of the really newer and futuristic wallpapers can do amazing things, and they resemble and sometimes literally are screens. So LED can be embedded in them, and you can change the image. The lower end of technology, there are these wall decals that can sort of be constantly moved around, so you're really sort of changing spaces all the time. So there's a lot more fun to be had.
I have this sense, and maybe it's wrong, maybe you'll correct me on this, but that wallpaper feels more of a kind of distinctive personal choice maybe than other ways of decorating a room. It's quite imposing, and so one person might love it and the next might dislike it. Do you think that's fair? Is wallpaper the ultimate measure of personal taste?
I would say so, because, you know, it's more of a commitment to put on and take off, right? If you're not using these removable decals, it is somewhat of a process to put it on and take it off. So it says, you know, it implies commitment. It also surrounds you so thoroughly that it will tend to disappear to the person who's living in the space, but it will be the first thing that someone notices and the second they walk in. So the choices are quite profound, one, if you will. It really is sort of the color of your reality, if you will.
Thank you to you both. I've been speaking with Jude Stewart, Chicago-based design writer and journalist and author, and Michael Leck, curator at the Carolyn Simpson Library and Research Collection. We've been talking wallpaper. We didn't even get to Florence Broadhurst, who's a local champion of the form. But if you have a favourite bit of wallpaper in your home, in your office that you see, take a snap of it and put it on the Blueprint for Living Facebook page. We'd love to see an example of the wallpaper that makes you go, You're listening to Blueprint for Living here on RN. With me, Michael Williams.
You're listening to Blueprint for Living on RN and the ABC Radio app. Have your say on this and other stories at the Blueprint for Living page on the RN website.
Well, to quote the Game of Thrones TV promo, winter is coming. But we're not talking dragons here, we're talking comfort food. Producer Margot Foster recently found herself in the midst of a dinner party discussion about how to make the perfect porridge. There were many firmly held opinions around the method, ingredients and tradition, but no agreement at all. So Margot went to Scotland. That's right, that's how you solve a dinner party debate. She went to Scotland, the heartland of porridge, to find out for herself how to make a good one. She's in a village called Humby, which is southeast of Edinburgh. Her host is Lady Hilly Mengus, that's right, and they're joined in Hilly's kitchen by her friend Morag Taylor to learn the correct way to make proper porridge. Just a warning for those sensitive ears, spurtles are involved.
I was taught to make porridge by my great-aunt, Mary May McLaughlin, a lovely, very traditional, fey Scottish lady.
And Morag, your experience with porridge?
You always talked about making the porridge with Katie.
Yeah, Katie and I had our porridge every Saturday morning. Katie was my old neighbour. She's now in a nursing home, but she is 89 and she was a great friend of mine. And she used to make the porridge with the traditional oatmeal, but latterly, when I was making it for her, we just made it with the porridge oats. But she used to criticise every time and we had a great laugh about it. Because she was a perfectionist on cooking anyway, Katie.
So what would Katie say? You'd need to have oatmeal. What is oatmeal?
It's oats.
Okay, here we have...
These are my two favourite oatmeals. This is the oatmeal of Arford. And that one is... Well, one of them is the pinhead oatmeal.
This is the pinhead.
That's the pinhead, which is, you know, just much, well, you can see it's much...
It's a stumpy little grain, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's this one, the Aberfeldy oatmeal.
Right, so you're very specific about the kind of oats that you use for your porridge, but Morag, tell me what you use when you make porridge daily.
I have to confess, I just make it with the Scotch porridge oats.
So they're flakes.
Yes, which is much quicker to make and is part of modern day life, I suppose. But my mother would make it with the oatmeal, and some people soak it the night before and then they boil it for 30 minutes. And then my old uncle, who's 89 as well, he makes it every day with the oatmeal, and he says, and then you leave it to sit for 30 minutes to settle. I would think it'd be stone cold by then, but he says no.
Okay, so we'll stick it on the left hand over the arm.
So that's the pinhead.
How did you measure the quantity?
I just looked at it. It's amazing because it swells up so much, you know, so you only put a wee bit in.
According to my uncle, and this is quite a laugh, because he says he uses a whiskey glass to measure out his oatmeal.
Does he?
And it's about half a whiskey glass, but of course I don't know what size the whiskey glass is. Anyway, he uses half a whiskey glass of oatmeal to a pint of water.
Yeah.
Which I thought was quite a lot. And another secret ingredient is salt.
Yeah, always.
All the older generation are very particular about how much salt. And when I used to make it for my gran, she used to always tell me that I didn't have enough salt in it. And interestingly, so did Katie.
Yeah.
She'd say, oh, there's not enough salt in that.
So not enough salt. How much salt would you use? Is it just a pinch or a teaspoon?
Oh, no, a teaspoon. At least a teaspoon.
And then, you know, actually, funny enough, my great aunt who taught me to make porridge, we would always have then salt on the porridge as well afterwards. The soak porridge on there, and what's already happened, as you can see, is that the water has become milky. That's presumably the starch, is it, from the porridge? I don't know.
Yep.
But then you're supposed to use a spurtle.
Yeah, absolutely. But the dogs chewed our spurtle, so we don't have a spurtle.
Do you have a spurtle, Morag?
I don't have a spurtle.
What about your uncle?
Yes, he has a spurtle, and my mother has a spurtle, but I don't. Have a spurtle.
So just explain what a spurtle is. Is it designed purely for porridge?
Yes, traditionally, yes. It's just like a wooden spoon, but it doesn't have the spoon bit on the end, it's straight.
So it's. And it was just a designated porridge stick, not for dogs.
Yeah, not for dogs. Yeah.
Well, if the idea is that you stir it continuously until it's through the boil, then it's maybe giving it a better texture than using a spoon, maybe.
Well, actually, funny enough, it feels completely different stirring it with a spurtle.
That's amazing.
Here, come and try this, Maureen. Try the difference between those two. That's extraordinary.
Hilary, you're cooking it on the Aga. You don't have much temperature control here.
No.
Is this the best machine for cooking your oats on?
I know, it's just the best machine for cooking anything on.
I was going to say that. I second that one.
So what is it about the heat of the Aga that makes cooking porridge a doddle for you?
It's because you don't have to think about it, you know, and nothing ever burns, you know. So you have two. The Aga is a great big, enormous sort of solid range, really, which is fired by oil. And A, it's just immediately hot. You've got nothing to turn on or warm up. But also, it's just a constant heat.
I have heard that you're supposed to stir it clockwise.
Tradition does say that you're meant to stir it in the same direction.
Does it?
But, yeah, the traditional way, and as what my uncle said, that was the traditional way, but I don't know if it's just an old wives' tale, maybe.
You don't eat it standing up as well. Is that another story?
That's a story. I don't eat it standing up. Never would eat my porridge standing up.
So the other thing I've heard of is the porridge draw. Would your uncle have had a porridge draw, perhaps, if he made a swag of porridge and kept some for later?
I didn't ask that, but I have heard of the porridge drawer. Mm. That sounds a bit disgusting to me.
So the leftover porridge went in the drawer where it solidified, and then you cut a piece off for your lunch. And isn't that where the expression a piece comes from? That, well, I don't know.
Possibly.
We've now moved it from the boiling ring onto the simmering ring.
It looks different now, doesn't it? It's completely
it's just
different.
Gently doing away, as they say.
So, Hilary, here comes the pot. It looks great. See, I'm so used to having flaked oats.
Yeah, I'm used to having flaked oats as well, so to be honest, this is a nice wee treat.
What's your preferred way of eating this porridge now?
I prefer to have honey and cream.
Here's sugar, milk, cream. Hang on, honey. Okay, and I'm very particular. I would rather have an old silver spoon.
Now, I'd like to put some honey on. It's good.
I'm just having it with milk and salt. Extra salt.
It's true comfort food, isn't it?
Yeah. There's just something lovely about it, though, isn't there? Porridge just, because it's something you had when you were little, it's a sort of security blanket.
It's lovely, actually.
Mm. Margot Foster stirring the porridge pot there, and there's a full-blown feature article teasing out the subject on the Blueprint for Living program page. Photos, recipe, everything spurtle-related that your heart might desire. Here's Colin Bissett with his latest look at the change makers of architecture, and he's asking how someone best known for restoration work might shape what's yet to come.
At first glance, the impact of Eugène Viollet-le-Duc on the world of architecture seems rather slight, certainly for those outside France. Born into a bourgeois family in Paris in 1814, he seemed determined to tread his own path, deciding to train with a practicing architect rather than enroll at the École des Beaux-Arts. His hunger to learn about architecture impelled him to travel extensively to see as many buildings as possible, which led him to conclude that there was nothing finer than a Gothic cathedral. It's not surprising that it's the restorations of many major French buildings that he's most famous for. It was Viollet-le-Duc who added the perforated spire and the famously grotesque gargoyles to Paris's Notre Dame. And it was he who added the witch's hat roofs to Carcassonne's medieval walls. He believed that restoration should enhance what had gone before, even if he completely made it up. Today, many view his work as nothing more than pastiche. But this is not the reason he's important. He was a theorist and wrote in great detail about structure and the possibilities of the new industrial materials, such as cast iron. Crucially, he suggested that iron arches and supports should be exposed rather than hidden behind masonry. No one before had expressed in such detail how this would be achieved. Naturally, he used the example of a Gothic cathedral, whose columns and buttresses made it clear how the building was supported, while also, as a byproduct, giving it an elegant beauty. Metal framing could do the same, he stated, recognising that engineering would now have to become more important, which engineer Eiffel demonstrated beautifully a few decades later in the middle of Paris. This, then, was a world away from the accepted approach where the structure of a building always came second to its appearance. It's exactly what architects promote today. Viollet-le-Duc's love for decoration remained, focusing on the organic shapes of leaves and flowers, which influenced the Art Nouveau movement of the 1890s and the work of Spanish architect Gaudí, as well as spreading across the Atlantic to become the signature decoration for the new skyscrapers of Chicago. It's hard to believe that a man whose most famous buildings looked like Disney castles helped shape the direction of modern architecture. But Viollet-le-Duc's dissection of the architecture of 600 years before was to be a major influence on everything that followed. And that's something to ponder the next time you see an exposed steel beam in a new building.
Colin Bissett there, paying tribute to one of the architectural world's change makers, and it is absolutely appropriate that we finish today's show on one of Colin's segments because they're the personal favourites of our very own change maker in here at Blueprint for Living, our executive producer, Mark Wakeley. Mark's retiring from the ABC after an extraordinary 31 years at the end of this week, and he is going to be sorely missed. He has been absolutely instrumental in putting Blueprint for Living together. As a former producer of The Comfort Zone and By Design, Mark's knowledge of and passion for architecture and design has played a crucial part in that bit of the Blueprint for Living patchwork. But his generosity, his insights, and his creative fingerprints are all over everything we're trying to do with this show. He's been such a support to me and a champion of this show, and he's really mentored countless broadcasters and producers across the ABC in his time here. We're very sorry to be losing him, and we're going to miss him enormously. We wish him the best of luck in whatever he does next. Honestly, 31 years, he would have got less time for murder. Thank you so much, Mark. That's us for the show for this week. We'll be back next week where we talk about hitchhiking, amongst other things. Do remember to send in your stories. But for now, we're out of here. Bye, Mark, and thank you so much.